Oh, there's no place like America's infrastructure for the holidays.
For some reason, driving around here sometimes is just kind of stressful, and sitting on the bus isn't.
As Americans think twice about driving this holiday season, all across the country, they're seeing just how much work there is to do to make travel smooth. On-time trains and huge holiday pains. It's Infrastructure Holiday Monday on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 22nd. Good morning, John. But, and a big but. Smooth travels? Do those
no,
two words
smooth.
Ever
not smooth.
Go together?
No. People are coming face to face with the infrastructure in America this holiday.
In this hour, we're going to talk about that, as well as car maker troubles, this time in Japan. Also, the importance of grease and some religious meals. And also a few pages for America's briefing book for President-elect Obama. This one on water resources. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
Winter's kickoff is proving brutal. Storms across the nation have paralyzed holiday travel, knocking out power. They brought sub-zero temperatures. One frustrated traveler in Buffalo spoke to WKBW.
We're certainly trapped. We have no place to go. There's no Burger King. There's no nothing. So we are here on this seat.
Trapped without a Burger King sounds like a hostage situation to me. That's right. Hours in the airport with no flame-broiled triple whopper. Drivers aren't faring that much better. Roads are slick and visibility is scarce. Multiple car pileups on several Midwest roads sent many drivers to the hospital. But staying on the highways, gas prices are now at their lowest levels in 5 years. The average price of a gallon of regular goes for $1.66. Hard to believe.
In Denver, investigators are hoping to learn more today about what caused a plane to veer off a runway and catch fire. They have the plane's black boxes, and they'll analyze those today, as well as take a look at the wreckage and interview the pilots. The passengers and crew all escaped alive, though with some injuries. Overseas, the two Mumbai luxury hotels occupied by terrorists are now open for business. The executive from one of them, Ratan Kiswani, says many people turned out.
We didn't have a seat free in any of the restaurants, including the lobby lounge of the hotel. That would kind of indicate that there was no reluctance to come back to the hotel.
The hotels opened only partially and with increased security. Some areas are still under repair.
Also in South Asia, at least 8 people are dead after suspected U.S. missile strikes in northwest Pakistan. The U.S. has hit the area hard lately, hunting for militants blamed for attacks in neighboring Afghanistan.
Iraq's parliament is delaying a vote on the future of foreign troops there. A recent deal extended the American military presence, but non-American troops are technically only allowed to stay until the end of the year. There's a proposal to allow non-American troops to stick around through July, but it's not clear when a vote will come on that.
In this atypical economic year, typical holiday weekend, end-of-year doldrums, the S&P and the Dow finished relatively flat last week, and both are expected to open flat or slightly lower. We'll follow that, and Asian indices are lower this morning. We're talking about travel today. We want to hear your stories, positive and negative, right?
Absolutely. Delays in train stations, delays at the bus station. Are you driving, or are you simply staying at home to avoid all of those traveling problems?
Is it smooth sailing or Godzilla versus Megalon when you tangle with the infrastructure on this holiday weekend and all this holiday period? 877-8-MY-TAKE for your stories, or mytake@thetakeaway.org. How does it change you?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
This train goes to all terminals. The next stop will be Terminal 1.
The comforting robotic voice there of some of the newest bits of infrastructure in the New York area. That's the voice of the JFK Air Train, which takes passengers from subway stops to various terminals at JFK Airport. As it happens every year, the infrastructure all over the United States is tested as millions of Americans take to the roads, buses, trains, and, of course, airports around this country. We've asked some reporters to join us today to talk about infrastructure because the issue is particularly important this year. Barack Obama has suggested that billions of dollars of tax money is going to be used to upgrade upgrade the country's infrastructure as part of the stimulus package for the economy, which could make holiday travel better in the future. Joining us now is Eric Whitney, who is a reporter at Colorado Public Broadcasting. He's in Carbondale, Colorado. He visited the Denver area this weekend. And Susanna Capilouto is news director at Georgia Public Broadcasting. She was in Atlanta. Susanna, what's the top headline in Atlanta?
I guess we have stranded travelers at our airport because it is the largest airport in the world. So with all the snow and ice everywhere, we have stranded people. But other than that, it's just cold.
Well, Eric, what did you find at the Denver terminal? The particular problem in Denver is that the airport is so far away from Denver, and getting there, if you don't take a cab or drive, is actually quite difficult. Eric?
That wasn't the case that I found in terms of taking the public transit from downtown Denver to Denver International Airport. It was pretty easy, cost $9, took a little under an hour, and everybody I talked to on the bus said they've been doing it for a long time, and they find it really easy and convenient.
In general, though, public transit is a new thing for the city of Denver, which isn't used to the kind of light rail and the more reliable transit systems that we have in the east. And one of the people that you talked to actually suggested that this was something of a cultural issue, mass transit out there in Denver. I want to play this, and I want you to tell me a little bit about this woman, Sandra Rush, who you talked to.
I had a bunch of friends come in. I mean, 18 friends come in for a reunion this summer, and I told them all, take the bus. It's only $4.50. And you know what? I don't think any of them did. I think they all took cabs because they're from the East Coast.
So here's a Denverite, a kind of a public transit zealot, talking about East Coasters taking cabs. Are people really on the sort of public transit bandwagon out there in Denver?
I think the locals are. The RTD, the district that runs the public transportation in Denver, says about 200,000 people a month ride just the airport bus alone, and they think they're going to be up over 2 million riders this year. So the locals know about it. I think if you fly into DIA and you see all the signs for ground transportation, et cetera, or if you're just used to taking cabs, then you might automatically go and hop in a cab and then, you know, face some sticker shock when you get into Denver half an hour later and you're paying, you know, upwards of $50, $60 for that cab ride. But if you're in the know, then you can go to the city bus stop, hop on, give them your $9, or like Sandra, if you're over 65, it's only $4.50, and an hour later, you're right in the heart of downtown Denver. So it's if you're in the know, it's the cheap way to go.
And strong economic incentives there, Eric. There are some other kinds of incentives in the Atlanta area. Susanna Capilouto talked to Perry Holbrook. Let's listen to this, and then Susanna, you can tell me what Perry's reaction was to the train trip to the airport.
From the North Spring station, which is where I usually get on, I guess it's about a 40-minute train ride. And I just don't like the traffic, and I'd like the convenience of the fact that the train drops you off right at the airport.
So, Susanna, again, people loving the train there in Atlanta.
Well, there's one way where the train goes. A lot of people say that our train system is underdeveloped. It doesn't go many places. It only goes north and south, east and west. But the one place it does go is the airport. And that's where a lot of people take it. They park at a station in the suburbs, and they get on the train, and it's cheaper. It only costs $1.75 one way, and you are right at the terminal. You don't have to do any of those parking thing where you get off and you know, leave your car for several days. So in that sense, that's where our transit is very convenient. But in other places around Atlanta, a lot of people say that it's not developed enough to get you many places.
Well, that's the issue in Atlanta, Susanna, because even though this is convenient to the airport, there are a lot of people who aren't served in the center city particularly, and the interstates around Atlanta are extraordinarily crowded. What is the shovel-ready project, you think, in Atlanta that could immediately benefit from a stimulus package?
Well, the shovel-ready one is what they call the Beltline, is one of those inner rings of that they want to do around Atlanta. But also MARTA, that's Metro Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority, we call it MARTA, has something shovel-ready, but what they first need is some cash because they are $40 million in debt.
Yeah.
And if they don't get any help because they get no state funding, they only get city and some federal funding, and they really need the money. Otherwise, they say they might have to, you know, up the fare a little bit just to make ends meet. So they're really banking on a stimulus package.
Well, shovels full of money is really the issue here. Andrea Bernstein is here in the studio. You were late because you were stuck in the New York infrastructure, right?
Right.
I mean, you're a senior reporter here at WNYC, but your new responsibility as a reporter is going to be to take a look at this from a national and global perspective. Susanna was talking about shovel-ready projects in Atlanta. What do you see as the sort of shovel-ready issue here in New York? And I know you spent some time at the airports over the weekend.
Well, this is the big debate right now, because the shovel-ready projects tend to be like the, you know, water systems of upstate or bridges in Montauk, and the transit systems are sort of right as we speak trying to gear up so that they can convince these members of Congress that they can get these projects going quickly enough to be part of the stimulus package. The problem in New York, which is obviously, you know, the biggest mass transit city in the country, as elsewhere, is transit's been so starved that the dreams haven't been big. And that's affected the airport, too. I mean, the biggest capital project in New York in recent years was the AirTrain.
Right, that we heard the sound there at the top.
And it's only about a 2-mile train ride. It does take you right into the New York City transit system.
But only to JFK Airport.
It takes you only to JFK. Well, Newark.
There's
also a system that takes you to Newark. But the even though it's a very quick ride, it's cheap. If you already have a Metro card, you only have to pay $5 more to get out to the airport. But the problem is when you're coming back, particularly if you're coming from a foreign country, maybe with a lot of luggage, the signage is weak. So you wouldn't necessarily know to get on the AirTrain. And then once you're on it, it's very hard to transfer into the New York City a transit system, either the commuter rail or the subway, because there you can't figure out where to go. You go from having these big signs that say AirTrain right. to tiny little screens that tell you Penn Station.
And, you know, that's part of the cultural shift in infrastructure. I mean, we're so used to reading the green signs on the interstate to figure out where to go here in the United States. If we shift to a rapid transit or a mass transit strategy in places like, Eric, Denver, there's going to be a lot of retraining to do, wouldn't you say, Eric?
I think the people that use public transit in Denver, I think there are quite a few of them. You know, we've had light rail for a few years now. It's sort of like the MARTA system in Atlanta, except only half, so it only goes north-south. We don't have a good east-west link. People are anxious for that to get out to the airport. But people in Denver, you know, actually use more public transit than most people would assume, although cars are still the dominant species in Denver.
And, Susanna, what about beyond the Atlanta metro area? Is there Amtrak does serve Georgia, but is there anything to extend Amtrak's reach that would help the people of Atlanta?
Not really. I mean, our Amtrak station is so tiny, you can hardly find it.
It's kind of an embarrassment.
I mean, it's like hidden.
It's an embarrassment, really, actually.
It's amazing if you think of, you know, that this used to be the city where the railroads meet. Now all that is shifted to the airport. And you can go to New Orleans, you can go to D.C. Now, there are some thinkings about maybe a line from Atlanta to Chattanooga. There are some thinkings about a line from Atlanta to Athens and also from Atlanta sort of south into Macon, some of those light rail in the future. There are some projects sort of on the drawing boards for that. Chattanooga would be going from to the airport in Chattanooga to relieve sort of Hartsfield. So, you know, those are all future things that are sort of in the planning, but none of them shovel-ready.
All right, well, let's find some shovel-ready stuff, because we're going to be talking about this throughout the next year. Susanna Capiluto, news director at Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for joining us. And Eric, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Eric Whitney is a reporter at Colorado Public Broadcasting. What is the issue of determining what's shovel-ready and not as we go forward in the next year or so?
The standard that they're using is right. whether it can be up and running in 90 days. Now, there's some transit advocates saying shovel-ready should be changed, the definition should be changed so that a project that could start in 120 days or 180 days could get included in the stimulus package. It could be phased in, which would get some of these transit right. projects ready to get considered by Congress.
Well, it's all about defining shovel-ready. I'm going to use that phrase with my kids, I think. Andrea Bernstein is a senior reporter here at WNYC News. Thanks for joining us. Her beat is infrastructure, and here she is out at JFK trying to figure out whether people like the JFK AirTrain or not.
How many times do you think you've done this?
Maybe 7 times.
A lot of times. You're a convert.
Yeah.
Do you ever take a taxi?
Yes, but sometimes it takes longer, and of course it's more expensive. And also with the traffic, you never know. So I personally think that the public transportation is more reliable than cabs in the rush hour especially.
What do you think? How has infrastructure changed you, particularly holiday time? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Travel stories for us. Please send them. Please.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I think it's safe to say that people's possibly most memorable travel experiences happen around the holiday, and they're the ones, particularly if they're tangling with
definitely
the infrastructure.
Definitely in the top five.
I would say. And if they're tangling with the infrastructure and it doesn't go well, those experiences are likely to change them. We want to hear if you've changed the way you travel because of your holiday travel experiences. Are you taking the train instead of planes? Have you sworn off Greyhound or sworn off Amtrak or sworn off air traveling? Or are you just not traveling at all? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Speaking of traveling, many people are going to be getting on the roadways this week as they celebrate the holidays. And as for the car makers, not a happy holiday at all. We've heard all about the U.S. automakers' troubles, and now there's trouble for Toyota. The company warned it would post an operating loss for the first time in its history. We turn now to Garel Reese, a director of the Center for Automotive Industry Research at Cardiff University Business School in the U.K., for his thoughts on this latest development. Welcome, Garel.
Thank you very much.
For the first time in 71 years, Toyota is not going to be posting any gains. Very painful.
Yes, Toyota, as that implies, doesn't do losses. So what this shows is, if anybody needed any more convincing, that the world motor industry is not in a recession, it is in a depression already. And consequently, a company like Toyota, which in recent years has made more profits than all of the other vehicle manufacturers in the world put together, even they now are slipping into the red. And I think there was a foreshadowing of this in the at the end of November, when the credit agencies took away their AAA rating to a AA, which is still vastly better than any other vehicle maker.
Right.
But nevertheless, that was clearly a straw in the wind. And at that time, Toyota was talking about a 60 to 70% reduction in profits. And this shows how quickly the whole position is unraveling for the vehicle makers in the world. It literally alters from day to day in a very fundamental way.
And so what does this announcement mean for the company, both in Japan and here in the United States?
Well, it certainly means that when things really get more difficult, they are a car maker like everybody else. And they will be, again, seeking, as Japanese firms always do, to squeeze even more costs out of the system. They will use that cost saving to try to push the pain onto other vehicle makers. In other words, they will try to increase their market share. They'll try also to push the vehicles which perhaps have bigger margins. There's some things they can't hide from, because of the huge increase in the value of the yen against the dollar. That's played havoc with margins. And also the decline of sales in India and China has caught out all the Japanese manufacturers. So they will do what the Japanese normally do, use the present position as a challenge, but a bigger challenge than one they've ever faced before. And it's unlikely that they will actually emerge from the loss-making position for about another 18 months. And indeed, there things have to be done to their model range. In Europe, it's interesting that they are the second largest decline in sales this year. The only company that's doing worse than them in Europe is General Motors. So they do have things to attend to with their models, and also their quality rating in the U.S. with the J.D. Power survey, etc., has been slipping for the last 2 years. So I hope it's not what the English statement says, every dog has its day, and that Toyota now is entering a period of perhaps longer-term decline. I think it's too early to say that. But nevertheless, they haven't entered this recession as well as some of their other rivals in Japan or in Europe.
But part of their success over the decades has been this business model that's flexible. So in terms of cost-saving measures that you're noting, you're talking about things like freezing expansion plans that they set out, suspending bonuses, and reviewing dividends. to shareholders? Are there other things that they can do that they are in a position to do that, say, GM and Chrysler are not in order to move forward?
Well, certainly there is the flexibility with payments. There's also flexibility in terms of the size of the workforce. Although Japanese firms are supposed to have jobs for life, it's not nearly as clear-cut as that. People can be transferred into the suppliers. They'll expect their very flexible suppliers, which very often is a completely different supply base to the American manufacturers in the States and the suppliers in Europe, etc. Those also will be urged to find their own cost-cutting measures to be passed on to Toyota. And this is what the company expects. So they work with their suppliers. They've done that over the decades. And again, it will be, in a sense, business as usual when they're facing a crisis. And it is their flexibility. It is their basic efficiency. But also, that's the supply side. It's the demand side also that must be looked at here. And there are a few disturbing signs that the cars and pickups are not quite as sellable as they were. The decline in November in the States for Toyota was 31%. All right, that's much better than General Motors and Chrysler in the 40s, but it's no better than Ford, say, and much worse than Volkswagen at 19%. So for once, the magic seems to have gone out of the model range. And that is much more difficult to address because it's not in their gift to, in a way, solve it. It's, that's the decision of the consumer. So they're going to have to be very, very adroit in their marketing to do something that they haven't been used to, and that is to try to persuade the consumer that these products really are better than they were. The consumer in the past has simply accepted the Toyota product is excellent, let's buy it.
So essentially, Toyota has two enormous challenges before them. They've got to strengthen their product, and they've also got to weather the economic storm. Thank you very much. Gerald Reese is the director of the Center for Automotive Industry Research at Cardiff University Business School in the United Kingdom. And now we turn to Femi Oke, who is an expert on the latest headlines. Good morning.
Good morning there to you. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. And some good news if you're planning to hit the road for the holidays. A national survey puts gas prices at the lowest point in almost 5 years. The national average price of a gallon of regular gas is $1.66. Now, driving may be a little bit tricky if you're heading up towards the northeast. There were blizzard warnings in Maine and storm warnings for Massachusetts. And Anna Allen faced some challenging driving conditions in Portland, Maine.
You can only see literally about 5 feet ahead of you. When I came into work, I couldn't even drive. I had to have someone drive ahead, four-wheel drive.
Now, out west, much of Washington State and Oregon are covered with snow, and Chicago's O'Hare Airport has cancelled more than 100 flights. The trial of five men accused of plotting an attack on the Army's Fort Dix is almost done. The jury told the judge that they expect to reach a verdict sometime today, and all are charged with conspiring to kill military personnel and attempted murder. Their lawyers say that they weren't plotting anything. Now, people are cutting back in lots of areas and when they're trying to deal with the economic troubles, and that includes pets. Now, animal advocates say that Americans are giving their pets to shelters in growing numbers, and economic troubles have made it tougher to pay for food and vet bills. That's a look at your news headlines for now.
Thanks very much, Femi.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Morning, everyone. Quick infrastructure story. I was traveling on the West Coast a few years back with all four kids, and we had like a four-hour delay. And I had the presence of mind to bring two little speakers with me to hook into the DVD player, and we plugged it into the wall. You know, and somebody came up to me and they said, dude, that is so smart. And within about 15 minutes, there were 30 kids watching a little movie all on the floor at the airport.
And I should add a coveted plug, because there are not a lot of them in the airport. We were stuck
in the airport a couple of weeks ago, and everyone's sort of hovering
near the plug trying to...
We found the plug, we had the speakers, and we created a multimedia experience in a four-hour delay at an airport. What's your story of infrastructure dealing with travel, good stories and bad, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org? And, you know, if you think I did something wrong there, if it annoyed you to have the speakers nearby, you know, because sometimes people do that, you know, and they didn't put on their headphones, you know, call me and, you know, call me on that. But we're into the holidays, we're into the Hanukkah zone, and that means the beautiful feeling of that comfort food grease just making it into your blood and just turning you into a smiling,
so
happy,
great,
mellow person. Sunday marked the beginning of Hanukkah, a holiday ripe with culture, heritage, and family, and of course food. And to discuss all of that, our friend Melissa Clark, New York Times food writer, is here in the studio to explain the importance, the biblical importance, of grease this time of year, right?
Absolutely.
And
well,
it is?
It's usually, traditionally, it's olive oil, although sometimes you can use any kind of grease when you're cooking, anything to make your food rich and delicious. But it stems from the Hanukkah story itself, which is, you know, just to give a quick synopsis, the Jews were fighting the Syrian Greeks, and when they came, they won. They came back to Jerusalem to find the temple was sacked and burned, and there was only enough oil to burn in the lamp for one night, but they needed a lot more to clean this temple. So they burned this light, and it miraculously burned for 8 nights, and that's the story of Hanukkah. That's the story that we celebrate. And to commemorate that, food should be cooked in oil,
lots
in grease, and some of the most delicious things that we eat are latkes. You know, everyone knows about potato pancakes fried in oil.
Yum. Well, let's talk about that for a second, because this is a terror for me every holiday season. I want to make latkes, and I never do it right, and I always get this mush that falls apart.
I know,
and
exactly.
Everybody goes,
they're
John,
so
you're a Unitarian. Leave the latkes alone.
I know everybody should be able to make latkes.
Yes.
Yeah, they're not so easy to make. It's a real art.
Okay, I'll tell you the secret is squeezing the potatoes. Do you squeeze your potatoes when you make latkes?
You mean before or after you start cooking them?
Before you start cooking them. You need to grate the potatoes. I like to grate them on a coarse grind in the food processor instead of the fine one. So you grate your potatoes coarsely.
Coarse grind.
Right, exactly. Not the fine one, because then they turn to mush. Have you ever noticed some latkes are just kind of mushy?
Yes, that's
right.
What
right.
always happens to me.
Exactly. You're grinding
so
your potatoes.
Coarse grind, number one. Second.
Number two, put them in a colander in your sink and squeeze the moisture out.
So like with eggplants, you have to remove the fluid.
Exactly, because otherwise that's going to turn your latkes mushy. So you need to have the potatoes very dry. Don't add too much stuff to them. You just add a little bit of egg, salt, pepper. You can add flour, but you don't even need to. You can add baking powder. You don't even need to. And then fry them in very hot oil.
So if you dry them, you actually – because, see, I always figure, okay, this year I'm going to do lots of eggs and they won't fall apart,
right,
and it never
right.
works.
Right. That's why, because you think eggs are binding, which they are, but they're –
with the water, it counteracts
exactly.
it.
Right.
Oh. Exactly.
Or you add too much flour. I've had those floury latkes, and they're heavy, and they're just not robust.
You just poor goyim trying to do latkes. It's impossible. All right, so I'm eating one of your gelt cookies that you brought in.
Yeah, these are my homemade Hanukkah gelt.
This is a butter transport vehicle here.
Yes, it's just a way to get grease
into
your mouth.
They're called heaven.
Oh, good.
Right. They're not a vehicle of any kind.
Recipe, please.
They're luxurious,
yummy
cookies.
Butter, butter, and more butter, and then some sugar, butter, sugar. I'll give you guys the recipe for the website. But, you know, I wanted to make Hanukkah gelt because we always play the dreidel game in front of the menorah. You spin the little top, and normally you get chocolate. But what's fun is to mix it up and to add other things to the pot, so you're not just having the chocolate gelt. So I make things that look like they're coins, and this is a golden butter. I call it my golden butter cookie. It looks like a gold coin, right? And it just adds something, you know, interesting for the kids.
With sugar around the edges,
right? The sugar around the edges makes it shiny and sort of golden, I think.
You know, the food is more of the issue, it seems to me, part of the celebration in Hanukkah than the presents are in the Christmas tradition, it seems. And I guess you have a wide range of sort of food sources to choose from. When I lived in Israel for many years, quite a while ago, it was amazing to me how many sort of odd Israeli kinds of sort of twists on the holiday tradition. It seemed like Americans were much more traditional than Israelis were. What sort of Israeli
donuts are everywhere in Israel? I was just through Israel, and their donuts are everywhere, and they're very good.
They're always jelly donuts or jam donuts because that's a traditional. You want to put the fruit that you've had in the summer, you put it in your donut, and they're called sufganiyot. typical donut dough, very simple. Any donut recipe will do. And you just stuff it with some kind of really flavorful jam. And then that's what they eat in Israel. You know, but anything fried. I mean, in Morocco, they eat fried couscous with fried chicken in it.
Right.
In Israel, I mean, in Italy, the Jews eat fried chicken. And so anything that you're frying in oil is going to be Hanukkah food. So if you have a favorite fried recipe, I would say break it out for Hanukkah. Everyone's going to love it. As long as you're using oil, you're commemorating this holiday and you're commemorating the miracle that happened.
Now, what do you do with the oil when it's all done?
Ah, well, that's a good question. Don't pour it down your sink. Pour it in a little jar and then throw it out.
You mean the sink
would
be bad?
Do you filter it?
Exactly.
You can do it to biodiesel, you know?
You probably could. I bet we can find a website that'll take care
sure.
of that for you.
Absolutely. Do you use the same oil for all these things, or do you have to use different oil for your latkes?
You should use different oils. For your donuts, you want to use a neutral flavored oil. For your latkes, you can use schmaltz, chicken fat, or olive oil, mm-hmm. something like that. But as long as you're using lots of oil and you're making something delicious, you're in good shape.
What's a neutral oil?
Canola, peanut, safflower,
gotcha.
Something without a flavor of its
sure.
own.
Right.
So it's not going to interfere with the donut flavor.
And you'd never want to interfere with the donut flavor. More oil, more grease. It's part of the religious tradition. Melissa Clark, New York Times food writer, thanks for joining us. And Femi Oke has some headlines.
Thank you. Time just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Federal investigators in Denver will look at the remains of a Continental Airlines plane today. The plane's black boxes have been recovered from the wreckage. Robert Sumwalt talked about the black boxes and the damage done to the plane at a press conference yesterday.
Both main landing gear have been sheared off of the airplane. The nose gear is collapsed. It may be sheared off.
And the Boeing 737 was getting ready to take off when it skidded off the runway and caught fire in Denver Saturday night. Dozens were injured and nobody died in the wreck. The brother of the Iraqi journalist who threw his shoes at President Bush says that an apology letter was written because he was tortured. He says his brother would throw his shoes again if given the opportunity, and the journalist faces trial next week. The court says that he didn't mention torture in the investigation. Ireland's the latest country to announce a rescue package for its banks. The government's putting nearly $8 billion into its top banks, and they're also taking a controlling interest in one of them. Now, the news didn't seem to make much of a difference to European investors so far. Key stock indices in the UK, Germany and France are mostly flat. Stocks were mostly down in Asian markets, though Japan's Nikkei did close higher this morning. And the Colombian rebel group FARC says that it will hand over six hostages, and they've been held prisoner for several years. The FARC is believed to have hundreds of hostages, and they sometimes swap them for rebels held by the government. I sometimes wonder if I should say leftist rebel group rather than FARC. It's a little tricky to say on the air.
Well, it's trickier to be a member of the FARC these days, that's for sure.
Thank
you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Good morning, everyone. History was made in the NFL last night. Jeff Beresford Howe, our one-man tailgate party, is in the studio to talk about it. Yes, so last year it was the Miami Dolphins with the worst record in football, but this year the Detroit Lions can't even... I mean, the Dolphins can't even hold a candle to the Lions, who did what yesterday?
Lions got destroyed by the New Orleans Saints, and they have a chance to become the first team in the history of the league to go 0-16.
They're 0-15 now. The Saints beat them 42-7 in an absolute drubbing. Now, are they just doing this so they get a better position in the draft?
No. In fact, whether they win next week or not, they're going to go to Green Bay and play the Packers. Whether they win next week or not, they are the worst team in the league. They get the first-round draft pick. The game means nothing except avoiding the humiliation of going 0-16.
How demoralizing. I mean, just what Detroit needs.
Well, you know, this has been going on in Detroit for generations. I mean, this shows the weakness of the system where there's no relegation like in European soccer. A family can take a team and run it into the ground for generations, and that's what's happening in Detroit.
Now, unlike some other NFL cities, the Tigers are or aren't having attendance problems like some other teams
are
having.
You mean the Lions?
I mean the Lions. Excuse me,
Tigers
the Lions.
Would
I mean,
be
the
baseball.
Lions, the Tigers are baseball, right?
Yeah.
Is there a chance that this franchise would move? Certainly that's been the case in a lot of other cities.
Not as long as the Ford family owns it, obviously. Right. I mean, they would never do that. The NFL makes so much money from television and media that all the teams are profitable all the time, no matter how many people come to their games. So, no.
But this is a failure of the NFL principle of sharing talent that, as we saw with the Miami Dolphins last year, they had a terrible record, but now they're going to possibly make the playoffs.
And the reason is that they brought in Bill Parcells and he knocked some heads together and started hiring good people. I mean, the Lions never do that.
And you said they're owned by Ford.
Yes, the person, not the company.
And I guess what should they do next year? I mean, do they get another coach? What do fans think? Do they think this is kind of funny that it's gone 0-15?
The fans are angry and frustrated,
yeah, sure,
and
they're
voting with their feet. They don't go to the games anymore.
And if there was a halcyon moment of the Detroit Lions, what would it have been?
George Plimpton playing quarterback and writing Paper Lion.
Right. The Lions, I mean, I lived in that nexus, Route 94, 96 between Detroit and Chicago, and I was always a Bears fan. And it used to be that the Lions were competitive in that whole Midwestern set of leagues, both NFC and AFC. They haven't been competitive, though, really in years.
They haven't been competitive since the 70s, and even in the 70s, they were a pretty good team, but they were never in the league's upper echelon. This is a franchise that it's one of the worst franchises in professional sports in terms of management.
And there's an irony there, which is I also have a group of diehard fans who stick with the team every year, unlike in some other places.
Every NFL team does, but their number of diehard fans is going down every year. It's like the number of people who buy Detroit cars. It's still enough to make some money, but it's not working.
Well, is the NFL dissatisfied with how the team management is handling this, and would there be some sort of pressure for a change, or do they have autonomy here?
They essentially have autonomy. The NFL can't really make them do anything. The one thing they can do is what baseball did to the Cincinnati Reds when they were unhappy a few years ago. They can strip them of the marquee game.
Right.
And take them out of Thanksgiving.
They're already probably going to be taken out of Thanksgiving. There's a lot of talk about that. Jeff Beresford Howe, thanks for joining us, our one-man tailgate party who consults with us about everything sports, a Detroit 0-15 record, first in NFL history.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Monday, December 22nd. Good morning. Femi Okeh is here with the headlines.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. At least 8 people have died in suspected U.S. missile strikes in northwest Pakistan. It's the most recent in a series of strikes that began in the tribal area in August. The U.S. is targeting al-Qaeda and Taliban militants blamed for attacks in Afghanistan. The trial of 5 men accused of plotting an attack on the Army's Fort Dix is almost done. The jury told the judge that they expect to reach a verdict sometime today. All are charged with conspiring to kill military personnel and attempted murder. Their lawyer says that they weren't plotting at all. Aid work is becoming increasingly hazardous. The non-profit organization Doctors Without Borders says that conditions in places like Somalia, Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo are particularly difficult, and Zimbabwe is a disaster. Doctors Without Borders executive director Nicholas de Torrente says that Zimbabwe took a turn for the worst this year.
There's been an economic meltdown. The political situation worsened considerably with the elections, the contested elections, the crackdown on opposition supporters in the run-up to the election, and that's taken a massive toll on the people of Zimbabwe.
And Zimbabwe, according to Doctors Without Borders, is one of the top 10 worst humanitarian crises of this year. We have plunging temperatures sending out bone-chilling cold up to the spines of Midwesterners. We're expecting that to last through the morning. Also have storm warnings in Massachusetts and blizzard warnings up in Maine. And finally, co-ed dormitories are coming to the University of Chicago. Now, the change at the school is part of a nationwide university trend.
I went to University of Chicago. There were co-ed dorms there.
You could share in the same room as a girl.
Not in the same room.
No, this is the same room. All right. This is one step further.
That's not co-ed. That's cohabiting.
Well, cohabitation. About 30 other colleges around the U.S. do it.
I see.
Cohabiting, that is.
I don't think my dad would have been too thrilled about that one.
Oh, that's the sort of thing you don't tell your father.
I think that's right.
The University of Chicago was waiting to see if it would work, you know, before they tried.
Before they tried it. Thanks very much, Femi.
You're welcome.
Femi just mentioned Zimbabwe, where safe drinking water has become almost non-existent to the point where it's accelerated a cholera outbreak that's already killed at least 1,000 people, according to the UN. And that got us thinking about water, because 1 billion people on the planet don't have access to safe drinking water. At least 20 countries don't even have enough water to grow their own food. Here in the States, record droughts out west have residents looking to the Great Lakes for fresh water. It's an issue that issues that President-elect Barack Obama will have to address. Peter Glick, president of the Pacific Institute, a nonpartisan research group that focuses on social issues, joins us now to add a few pages to America's briefing book for the new president. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning.
So we take for granted here in the United States that we have clean water, fresh water, and that we don't have the kind of problems that many other countries do, but we certainly have a share of problems, and you outlined some of them in a new report. Tell us.
We certainly do. It's interesting, people forget, but more than 150 years ago in the United States, cholera was very prevalent here in New York, Chicago, New Orleans. There were terrible cholera outbreaks. Thousands of people died regularly. And we spent the money to invest in our water system to provide very safe, high-quality water for everyone. But that's not true around the world. And that's partly what we see going on in Zimbabwe. And in the United States, frankly, we're underinvesting in a lot of things, of course, but we're underinvesting in our water system. We're underinvesting in making sure that our water stays clean and making sure that our wastewater gets treated. And there are a whole series of water problems that have been ignored for a long time that need to be addressed now.
One thing I was really surprised about in reading about some of the work you've done is 80% of the water in this country is used to grow food?
Yes. Most people, certainly in the East, and I was born and raised in New York City, don't realize that the vast majority of the water that we use doesn't go to brush our teeth and flush our toilets and wash our clothes, but it's used to grow food. 80% of the water that's consumed goes to irrigated agriculture, and it's one of the reasons why the United States is one of the most, the largest exporters of food around the world, and that's a great thing. But we don't use that water nearly as efficiently as we could, and nearly as efficiently, frankly, as scarcity gets worse and worse, as we ought to.
And you talk about efficiency, because we tend to think of water as something that is constantly replenished. We think about snow and rain, snow that melts and comes down from mountains into waterways. Explain the dynamic of this problem of the drought out west and why they're looking to the Great Lakes for water.
Well, water is the classic renewable resource. You know, it doesn't matter how much we use from a river. The river will continue to flow when we get rain. But we can overuse even a renewable resource. We can overpump groundwater faster than nature naturally recharges it. And even though we're sitting in the middle of the hydrologic cycle, and of course in New York, when there's ice on the ground, we don't think about water shortages. Many parts of the United States are water scarce. The western U.S. is very water short. And so we tend to look to places that have a lot of water, like the Great Lakes, to move water from one place to another. But we can't move water very far. And that's one of the reasons why it's really critical that we use it as efficiently as we can. We basically need to do what we want with less water.
And as locally as we can. Part of that efficiency is trying to maintain the infrastructure as locally, because if you transport water, the evaporation issues suddenly bear on the efficiency issues, and you have all kinds of difficulties. And those have been political problems out in California. Thinking about water, though, and looking at the America's history with water, a lot of the law that we understand in this country that governs interstate cooperation, multi-government cooperation, even a sense of sort of property law relates to access to water around the world. The question of communities' interrelationship with water is a giant template for the rule of law all around the world. Do you see water rights as being a template for global cooperation in places like China and Egypt, in the Middle East, places like Eastern Europe?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's being debated now even in the UN, whether, for example, there is a human right to water. And I think unambiguously there is a human right to water. I think the UN's going to conclude that. And what that means is, in part, countries cannot deny their citizens water for political purposes and, frankly, need to do much more to provide safe water. And Zimbabwe is a great example of this, where an incompetent government has basically led to the complete failure of the water system and of course, the health system and many other systems there. We need to provide safe water for everyone. There are a billion people worldwide that don't have it today, and it's just inexcusable.
So what is your advice to Barack Obama?
Well, there are many things, of course, that the new administration has to deal with. But on the water side, first, we need to protect our water systems. We need to make sure that the water coming out of our taps remains clean and potable.
Is there some threat that it won't?
Well, if we don't invest in our water systems, then we aren't smart enough to catch pollutants as they enter. We don't monitor. We don't treat adequately. I think one of the reasons, frankly, that some people drink bottled water in this country, even though it's hugely expensive, is they're not completely convinced that their tap water is clean.
And, so there's an infrastructure issue with water.
And that's an infrastructure issue. This classic shovels ready issue. You have to invest in the system we have to protect it.
What about rights and equity?
On the international side, the U.S. could do so much more to help provide safe water and sanitation worldwide. We can provide technology, expertise, money, and we can ensure that billions of people who don't have access to the things most of us take for granted get access to those things.
And has that not happened because it hasn't been a priority, or has there been some kind of obstacle to doing those things you mentioned?
Well, it hasn't been a priority, and the obstacles are political primarily. I'll give you one number just that I think will shock most of you. We don't give very much money in foreign aid overall for anything. But on the water side, the entire U.S. contribution for helping water supply and sanitation projects for the entire continent of Africa is around $20 million a year.
Wow.
It's just completely inadequate.
53 countries.
And it's certainly within our means to do much more. And think about the enormous international goodwill we could accrue by providing the money and the expertise and the technology that we all take for granted.
We could be the OPEC of water technology, in a sense.
We could do so much good for so many people so easily.
Well, on that note, that's our takeaway. We can do so much more when it comes to access to water than we are doing here in the U.S. Peter Glick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Peter Glick is president of the Pacific Institute, a nonpartisan research institute that works to advance environmental protection, economic development, and social equity issues.
From water to travel, if you're traveling this holiday season, what do you think would help the infrastructure?
As someone who lives on Cape Cod, I'd love to see the rail line revived from Boston to Cape Cod. It's more than shovel-ready, but the highway lobbies are a barrier.
Yeah, I'd like a bridge, you know, to Moscow, too. Tell your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Here's your takeaway.
Toyota, as that implies, doesn't do losses. So what this shows is, if anybody needed any more convincing, that the world motor industry is not in a recession, it is in a depression already.
That's Gerald Rees, director of the Center for Automotive Industry Research at Cardiff University Business School, talking about the historic story today. Toyota will not report a profit for the first time in 71 years. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
It's a Bush administration going out of business sale, but Robert Redford's not buying.
And once these lands are taken away, they're gone. And gone doesn't come back.
On its way out of office, the Bush administration is offering up some prime wilderness for oil and gas leasing. Same old song, Drill Baby Drill, not a hit with environmentalists. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 22nd, and John, it's going to be a fight right down to the last hour between the environmentalists and the Bush administration.
They've been fighting for 8 years. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning. In this hour, we'll talk about that. Also about the auto bailout, jobs, and religious journeys. Today, those stories are coming up, but first, your top headlines.
Check your calendar, folks. It's officially winter, but you don't have to check your calendar if you're in most of this country. It's a frigid, windy, snowy mess from Washington State to New England. Maine hotel clerk Anna Allen is hearing horror stories from travelers and has had some trouble of her own.
You can only see literally about 5 feet ahead of you. When I came into work, I couldn't even drive. I had to have someone drive. I had four-wheel drive.
And she's one of the lucky ones. Flyers aren't so lucky. They don't even have anything to drive in. Hundreds of canceled flights of stranded travelers. And if you can get on the road, you will be happy about one thing, and that's that gas prices are at their lowest levels in 5 years. The average price of a gallon of regular gas goes for, you know the price?
$1.66 a gallon.
Right now, but you cheated.
Why?
Well, you looked.
I did, of course. Yeah, right. You asked me a question. I looked for the answer.
All right.
There you go.
Good. She looked it up.
And as for answers, President-elect Barack Obama promises a report on his transition staff's contacts with Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich. That report he will release by tomorrow. It's been widely reported that incoming White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel talked with the governor's office about the Illinois Senate seat that Barack Obama will be vacating. But the federal complaint charging the governor doesn't mention conversations between Blagojevich and the Obama transition team. In Denver, investigators hope to learn more today about what caused a plane to veer off a Denver runway and catch fire. They now have the plane's black boxes. They'll analyze those as well as take a look at the wreckage and interview the pilots. The passengers and crew, fortunately, all escaped alive, though with some injuries.
The two Mumbai luxury hotels occupied by terrorists are now back open for business. Here's a customer at the Taj Mahal Hotel.
We felt very emotional. We had tears in our eyes because it felt so good to be back, to see the place open, to see all the employees and management who were so warm, who were so hospitable.
An emotional reunion there in Mumbai. The hotels are opened only partially. There's increased security, of course, and many areas are still under repair. Eight people are dead after suspected U.S. missile strikes in northwest Pakistan. The U.S. has hit the area hard lately, hunting for militants blamed for attacks in neighboring Afghanistan.
On Friday, the Dow and S&P finished relatively flat. The Dow closed at 85.79 and the S&P at 887. So we're expecting a relatively flat open this morning.
Flat open, slightly positive. I don't know why the futures turned around, but something happened in the last hour, but light volume in this end of the year. We're talking about Columbia, South Carolina. It's a place that personifies the daily numbers of layoffs and sales drop-offs. It's kind of a microcosm of the economy. What are you seeing in your town or on your block that shows how the economy is doing, good or bad? Is the corner store closing? Are there storefronts vacant? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In a moment, we're going to talk about a community in America that possibly represents a real microcosm of what's going on broadly in the economy. They did everything right. They're a diversified community, but the impact of the financial meltdown and all of the unemployment and other issues are making life difficult in this place. But if you can guess the community, think about it. We'll be revealing that in a moment. But joining us now is Peter Morici, a professor at the University of Maryland School of Business and former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission and a good friend of ours. We wanted to talk about the fine print because, Peter, we wanted to discuss what the auto industry, the Barack Obama administration, and the unions are going to be nailing down as the implications of this $17.4 billion bailout is actually made clear, and they have a deadline of March 31st to do it. Peter, the auto bailout is certainly good for workers, so let's go over the details of the agreement first.
Well, the agreement requires that union workers in the Detroit 3, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, align their labor costs, that is their wages, their benefits, and the work rules with those of the transplants, and Nissan, Honda, Toyota. Each company basically has to pick a target company and align with that target. They can choose whichever one they want. Now, those are goals to be accomplished by March 31. If they don't accomplish those goals, they're supposed to give the money back, which basically means a structured Chapter 11 of some kind. However, you know, we're going to have a new president, and he can enforce those provisions as he pleases, because also the agreement says you can vary from these conditions if you can show a business plan that would make you viable, more or less, and uses technical terms for that. And so it's up to President Obama to decide what that means. And, you know, he is very beholden to organized labor, as he is the New York banks, for his victory. The Democrats are. And so there's all opportunity here for accounting mischief in terms of what the labor agreements mean for the long-term viability, because a lot depends on what you assume about future car sales, what the Japanese are going to pay here, you know, things of that nature. So you can, with a stroke of a pen, you can really change what a business plan says.
So I guess the devil is in the fine print here, and we're going to see that as we move forward. Why has compensation been such a gigantic issue on the auto bailout worth $17.4 billion and not so much of an issue on all of the various bailouts of the financial institutions?
Because it is so transparent as to what its impact is. I mean, when you're paying $20, $30 more an hour for labor to make cars, and cars in labor such an important component, you know that you can't be competitive. Also, in the testimony that the congressman received, basically the people that were not from the industry said that this had to be fixed. I testified on March 18th alongside the three CEOs when they first came to town to ask for the money. I was the outside expert. And I basically said that unless they align their labor costs, that they have the same work rules, that they restructure their debt and get rid of their legacy costs, they can't make cars competitively, and the Republican senators embrace that position.
Huh.
Well, I mean, you can go read the congressional
record. No, I remember your testimony. Peter, do you think there's a ground zero of the recession? Is there a town that's typical of what's going on in the recession, a place that embodies everything?
There's no place that's typical. I mean, ground zero, you're probably sitting on ground zero of the recession. The recession was manufactured on Wall Street, if it was manufactured any place in the United States. The recession has made what have been bad conditions now for a while in the auto patch worse. It's important to remember that in Detroit, they were losing money before the economy turned down.
And certainly the subprime issue predated the financial meltdown. Peter Morici, thanks for joining us. We're going to see if there is a typical community on Main Street, which represents all of these financial problems. Peter Morici, of course, our friend and a professor at the University of Maryland School of Business, former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission. Thank you, Peter.
Take care.
And a matter of fact, we do have some thoughts on that. Peter Goodman from our partners at the New York Times, he went looking for that city or place in the country that really personifies the daily numbers of layoffs and sales drop-offs and other economic fears and factors that are taking place in this country right now. And he discovered that Columbia, South Carolina, according to a whole host of indicators, really reflects best the country at large. Peter joins us now. Good morning, Peter.
Morning.
You have a front-page article today in the paper about Columbia, South Carolina. What is it about that city?
Well, we looked at a bunch of indicators, as you said. We looked at things like change in household net worth, real estate prices, percentage of manufacturing jobs, and the change in manufacturing jobs, financial services jobs. And we ran data. We had MoodysEconomy.com run data for the past decade. And the metropolitan area in the United States that comes closest to the national average, I mean, we built this index of all these indicators, and the city that jumps out at you is Columbia, South Carolina.
And why is that? What is it about that community? I mean, you tend to think of South Carolina, you think tobacco.
Yeah, I mean, there is that knee-jerk reaction, tobacco, textiles, and the Carolinas. Actually, Columbia is quite diversified. I mean, they have a tire factory. They do some software. The University of South Carolina is a big research institution. They're actually very invested now in looking at hydrogen fuel cells and biotechnology. There is some manufacturing. There are a lot of banking jobs. It is, for better or worse, and, you know, there isn't a perfect microcosm, but it's the closest we've got.
But given all of that diversity, you would think that Columbia, South Carolina, then would be able to mitigate themselves or itself against the economic landscape, as opposed to, say, communities in the Midwest that are mostly made up of the economy is mostly made up of the auto industry suppliers and other businesses related.
Well, again, it's a microcosm. It's not the worst hit. So this is not Ohio. This is not Michigan, as you know. This is a place that can mitigate to some degree, but there is there are a lot of people working for state government there. It's South Carolina's state capital. The university, though there are cuts at the university, is, you know, weathering things in terms of employment better than an industry like the auto industry, certainly.
So what did you learn from studying Columbia, South Carolina, about the rest of the country?
Well, I learned that there's a sense of desperation there, as I think there is through much of the country, as I've discovered in travels to other places. I mean, people who don't have jobs are having an incredibly difficult time finding the next job. They're worried about their unemployment checks running out, and they're having a difficult time just living on those unemployment checks. People who've never applied for aid are now applying for food stamps. People are getting support from whoever they can find, whether that's a boyfriend or a girlfriend or parents. I mean, you have people who are into their 40s, you know, now leaning on their parents for assistance if they're out of work or their hours have been cut. It's just a very, very tough economy out there.
Well, Peter, you describe relationships between individuals who are relying on each other. I'm wondering if Columbia tells a story of interrelationships between, say, the banking sector and the education sector and the governmental sector. For instance, I would think in a time where there are a lot of layoffs, people are going to be applying to the school. And maybe if there's going to be an economic stimulus package, there may be some hope for government workers, and that there may be some other sort of sectors of the economy that are much, much weaker. How does that interrelationship play out in the people you talked with?
Well, the focus in this piece is on how Columbia is now positioning itself to get some of this stimulus money that President-elect Obama is talking about unleashing once he gets into office. I mean the signals out of the new administration are, as a lot of your listeners are aware, we're talking about up to $775 billion to be spent on public infrastructure projects, you know, road building, improvements to sidewalks, classrooms. And I spent some time with the mayor of South Carolina, Bob Coble, who's been mayor there for 18 years, who's got this list of high-priority projects totaling $140 million, he says, you know, could be enacted immediately. They've already got the easements for roads. They've done the design work. You know, just give us the money, and we'll get people to work. And the interrelationship is such that, you know, he's looking to improve this InnoVista campus that the university has going, where they're focused on biotech and the hydrogen economy, on the theory that, you know, these are future jobs. So you not only get the construction jobs by building the campus, building the new buildings and the road improvements and bridges and such, but then you have jobs going forward in these new sectors of the economy.
So, Peter, would you say that there are actually things that the rest of the country can learn by taking a look at how Columbia is dealing with the troubles that we're facing?
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, it's early, you know, and this infrastructure spending is something that a lot of economists think has to happen, and yet there are a lot of question marks about how it's going to happen. I mean, in Columbia, for instance, they're focused, as I say, on this InnoVista campus, which a lot of economists think is a very good idea longer term to focus on high growth areas of the economy for jobs. On the other hand, they're looking to spend $54 million to complete sidewalk improvements to a street called North Main Street.
Looking towards Main Street, Peter Goodman, thanks very much. Peter Goodman reports for the New York Times, and he was telling us about Columbia, South Carolina.
The choice of what infrastructure projects is really sort of key. I mean, you could have a lot of unemployed hydrogen engine sort of professors who went to school thinking that there'd be a hydrogen engine project, but it didn't materialize.
Or it may come this time next month. I mean, as you say, a lot of communities are going to be looking at projects to jumpstart their economy. And clearly something we'll be talking about here on The Takeaway as each community measures the pros and cons.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Today we talked a bit about Columbia, South Carolina, a place that puts a face on the daily numbers of layoffs and sale drop-offs and other economic fears and problems that we're facing the country right now. What are you seeing in your town or on your block that shows how the economy is doing? Are stores closing? Are stores empty as we get closer to the holidays? We'd like to hear your thoughts at 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
So the Bureau of Land Management and environmental groups are involved in a pitched battle in the waning days of the Bush administration. It's been going on for a while, but there were some disturbing signs last week. And joining us to talk about this battle is David Albersworth, a senior policy advisor at the Wilderness Society. Dave, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Basically, the dispute is over 100,000 acres of drilling leases that would permit gas and oil exploration or even drilling on 100,000 acres in Utah. And it's in an area that has not been explored before. And first of all, I'm wondering why this battle is happening right now, Dave.
Well, this battle has actually been going on for the past 8 years. This particular battle that happened on Friday is just one sale in the quarterly lease sales that the Bureau of Land Management holds in the state of Utah and elsewhere throughout the West.
And is this one of those situations where the outgoing president is attempting to use regulatory authority to make something happen that legislatively wasn't really viable, or is this something else?
This is, I think, one of the initiatives of the Bush administration to put its stamp, its policy stamp on oil and gas development policies on federal lands in the West as they are going out of the door, yes.
Now, with the price of oil declining to, you know, in the mid-30s over the weekend, is it possible that it makes a better case for the Wilderness Society and other environmental groups?
Well, I think what we're hoping is that perhaps the silver lining here for the next 4 years is that the declining price of energy may provide the Obama administration with an opportunity to reevaluate these aggressive oil and gas development policies on public lands. We certainly hope they do that.
Well, certainly Robert Redford, who speaks personally about his familiarity with these lands, spoke very, very passionately about the potential, at least. Let's listen to what Robert Redford had to say.
There's so much deception, so much sleight of hand here. I mean, how would you feel if you had an heirloom that was centuries old in your family, someone came in while you were not looking, or they distracted you by creating something over here and they took it away from you? How would you feel?
Now, Dave, do you share that sense of manipulation and dishonesty? I mean, in the West, in fact, people are used to this battle going on over oil and drilling rights versus wilderness rights going back really more than a century.
Well, although that's true, I think what's happened over the past 8 years is that the Bush administration's policies favoring oil and gas development over the protection of all of these other values that Mr. Redford and the rest of us have been concerned about has been so extreme that there's just been rising opposition to those policies, not just in Utah, but elsewhere, states like Wyoming, Montana, Colorado, New Mexico, where traditionally a lot of people have supported the oil and gas industry. They've looked at what the consequences are of all of this aggressive development on these pristine lands and have decided that they have simply gone too far.
Now, drill, baby, drill, of course, was the mantra and the refrain at the Republican National Convention. On this sale that took place on Friday, where would it have an impact specifically? Are you familiar with the map?
Yeah, if I may, I'd just like to read you a very brief passage from what the BLM itself describes as one of the areas, Desolation Canyon. What they said about this area is that it is a magnificent, has magnificent wilderness qualities. It represents one of the largest blocks of roadless BLM public lands within the continental United States. It's a place where a visitor can experience true solitude, where the forces of nature continue to shape the colorful, rugged landscape. That is the Bureau of Land Management's own description of one of these areas.
Well, Dave, it sounds like it could use a couple of pumps and a few derricks in there and maybe some truck trails.
I'll tell you what, we have lots of pumps and derricks throughout the western United States. The Bush administration issued 35,000 drilling permits during the past 8 years, many of which aren't even being used. They've issued more drilling permits to the oil and gas industry than they can even use. We've got 45 million acres of public lands under lease, and to give you a sense of the size of that, that equals the land area of the states of New York, New Hampshire, and Vermont
All
combined.
Right. All right, but what if in this oil collapse that has taken place, environmental groups such as yours get the upper hand and during the Obama administration really shut down the development of future fossil resources, and all of a sudden when oil spikes up to $150 or $200 a barrel in 5 years' time, we will have wished we went into some of these areas. What do you say to that?
Well, we're not interested in shutting down the oil and gas industry in the West. The sad fact of this particular situation is that in Utah, had the BLM decided to protect all of the areas that we wished and asked for them to protect, there would still be opportunities for thousands of wells to be drilled on public lands elsewhere in that state.
And the Friday sale, any idea what it amounts to in terms of reserves potential?
No, I just don't have that.
Right. Well, that's hard to assess anyway. In many ways, that's the reason for going in to actually determine some of those numbers.
Right.
Well, it sounds like you suspect a positive outcome here. What's the next day in court?
The next day in court, I think, is in early January, January 12th, I think, and we'll find out whether the court wishes to impose a restraining order on the issuance or the conveyance of these leases.
Again, one more event before the inauguration. Dave Albersworth, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dave Albersworth is a senior policy advisor for the Wilderness Society in court with the Federal Bureau of Land Management on oil and gas leasing on 100,000 acres in Utah. And now we have headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thank you. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Now, it is officially winter, but you probably didn't need me to tell you that. People from the Pacific Northwest to New England are dealing with snow and freezing temperatures, and strong winds are making it feel even colder. An invisible fortress, that's what the Taj Mahal Hotel in Mumbai is being called. The Taj and Oberoi hotels reopened yesterday with new security measures in place. Now, it's been a month since terrorist attack, and last night Deepak Dutta, who is a survivor of the Mumbai attack, was the first guest to check into the reopened Taj Mahal Hotel. He said it was his way of fighting back the terrorists.
The only way we can do that is not to run away. We have to stand on our feet, just like people in UK stood back on their feet after all the terrorist attacks over there. And I'm just playing my small bit, doing the same thing.
And that was guest Deepak Dutta talking to Sky News earlier. Now, there's increased security at Mumbai's two luxury hotels, including dogs, security guards and X-ray machines. An Iraqi journalist who threw his shoe at President Bush will go on trial next
week.
It
was two shoes.
Shoes.
It was two shoes. I just want to be.
Very
wasn't just a single shoe incident.
Well,
it was a double shoe incident.
It was a double shoe incident.
Right.
And the shoes were size 10.
Good. Good. Anyway, continue.
Thank you. Muntada al-Zaidi.
Zaidi.
Thank you, John. Sure. Is accused of aggression against a foreign head of state. He will go on trial later this week.
A trial? I can't believe that. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome, John. Thanks for your help.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Of course, most places in the United States have a certain regional character based on interest, industry, ethnicity, But there are some communities in the United States that really sort of typify all of the diversity in the U.S. economy. And we were talking about Columbia, South Carolina a moment ago. What are you seeing in your town or your block that shows how the economy is doing? That might be a part of this microcosm that we're exploring. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. Is there a vacant storefront, a corner store closing, a neighbor putting homes up for sale, brother losing job? Those kinds of stories. That's what we're looking for.
There's certainly one place that is currently a hub of activity, and as we get closer to January 20th, we'll get busier and busier, and that's Washington, D.C., because officials are expecting record numbers at President-elect Barack Obama's inauguration next month. Millions of people coming from all over the country, and some of them are going to be driving and taking the train or perhaps flying, but not Ryan Bowen. Ryan joins us this morning from Austin, Texas. Good morning, Ryan. You're going to be riding your bike?
Yes. Good morning, Adora. How are you doing
today? Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm in Austin, Texas. It got a little chilly here the last couple of days, but I've been riding my bike from Los Angeles through Texas, and I'm going all the way to D.C.
And you decided to do this. You were inspired by the election of Barack Obama, right?
Yes, definitely. We've seen a progressive movement and the potential for political change that's unprecedented in these times. And I just wanted to get connected with this in one of the ways that I saw possible. And I ride my bike in Los Angeles, and a lot of my friends were purchasing their plane tickets. I didn't have the money for a ticket, so I thought, why not try a bike?
You know, Ryan, by my calculation, you've gone about 1,800 miles or so. Are you still in love with your bike, or is it something that you wake up and want to throw into a dumpster?
You know, the least stressful time of the day is when I'm on the bike.
Nice.
Really?
Hours of the day. It's like poetry when you're out there. It's amazing. You're in touch with nature in a way that it's an amazing experience. I got to say that I want to get more people on the bike to ride with me. That's one of my main goals with this is just to be out riding. It's an amazing, amazing experience.
Okay, you're 22 years old. You just graduated from Occidental College, and you were studying religious studies and Spanish, speaking of this amazing experience you're talking about in riding on your bike. But your idea is you want to send what message as you speak to us and others about this 4,000-mile trip on your bike that you're making from L.A. to D.C.?
The message that I'm trying to convey and that I've been investigating as I've been riding is where are people's hopes at in this time? It's a desperate time with the status of the economy, with unemployment as high as it is right now. I've been asking people in every town that I go through, what are their hopes for the future? And pretty much everyone I've said has looked at this with an outlook of optimism as a chance for us to really pull ourselves out of this tough situation that we're in. My message is one of hope, and I'm hoping to inspire people as well to join me in the ride and join me on the website, bikingforobama.com. They can follow along. Really, it's been an inspirational quest.
And I think you've inspired one of our listeners. Listen to this.
This is Gary Cecil from Highland Falls, New York. I was greatly heartened by the story of Ryan, the bicyclist, going from Los Angeles to the inauguration in Washington. I, too, took a bicycle trip across the country in the other direction during a presidential transition, arriving from New York in San Francisco on the day that Richard Nixon resigned from office in August of 1974. What Ryan is doing is something that I would encourage anyone to do, because later in life you can look back on that and say, you know what, if I did that, I can do anything.
There's a kindred spirit for you, Ryan. What do you think?
That's been great. The only thing I've been receiving is kindred spirits so far. People have been helping me out in every state and every town that I've gone to. I've had churches supporting me. There was a woman who made me look like a chump. She was in Fort Hancock. Her name's Ann Musto, and she's about 70 years old, I'd say, and she was starting her third world bicycle tour. So I thought going across the country was one thing, but she's going from London to Singapore in the spring.
Now, how are you supporting yourself? You mentioned that people are helping you along the way, but how organized does that have to be?
Well, I've got the website, and people have been purchasing T-shirts. That's one way that I created to foster the support that I need to buy the food that I need to make it across the country. I got to eat like 8,000 calories a day. So
8,000 calories a day?
Or else my body will start eating itself.
Wow.
The protein intake has to be high, and I've already lost about 15 pounds. So I got to keep eating But people have been supporting me on the website, from friends and family to total strangers who have been sending me positivity through messages, text messages. Everything has just been all positive energy that I've been receiving, and that's kept me motivated to keep going on. It was hard at first, but I've got such a momentous force behind me now with everybody seeing in on me and following through.
I hope you have a comfortable seat, Ryan. I hope you have a comfortable seat there on your bike.
Yeah, I definitely had to invest in some nice riding shorts.
And you're certainly hoping that 1 or 2, 3, 4, 10 riders are going to join along at some point with you.
My goal is to have 1,000, but I got 2 right now in Austin, Texas. We're headed to Houston today, so a little momentum here, and hopefully time we're within the last 2 weeks before the election. Maybe on the East Coast, folks will take a week off of work, and they're already heading that way north. They'll join along. That's one of my biggest goals.
We wish you luck, Ryan Bowen. Thanks so much for joining us. He's a writer and cycling activist on his way from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. on his bicycle.
We should get him a better cell phone, I think.
Yeah, there was a bit of an interference there, but he's a man on the go, so
we
can dish understand
for his
that.
Head. We can put it right on his hat.
And now we go to Femi Okeh, who's got headlines for us this morning.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Wall Street is open for business. We have the S&P down about 1.58, now about 2, and the Dow is up just a little bit, around about 8 points. Now, at least 8 people have died in suspected U.S. missile strikes in northwest Pakistan. It's the most recent in a series of strikes that began in the tribal area in August. The U.S. is targeting al-Qaeda and Taliban militants who have been blamed for attacks in Afghanistan. The Colombian rebel group FARC says that it will free 6 hostages. Now, they've been holding them in the jungle camps for years, but the group didn't provide any date for their release, and in the past they've tried to swap hostages for imprisoned FARC leaders. President Dmitry Medvedev has just been given an extra 2 years in office. The upper house of parliament in Russia has voted overwhelmingly to give final approval to a constitutional amendment which allows the Russian president an extension of his term from 4 to 6 years. The United States says that it no longer supports the power-sharing deal in Zimbabwe, and that was agreed in September by President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. The senior American envoy to Africa, Jendai Frazier, said that it's time for Mugabe to step down.
Robert Mugabe is a barrier to progress, and he should step down. He should retire. His time is over. The power-sharing agreement should be implemented, and it needs to be implemented with someone other than Robert Mugabe as the president.
That was Jendai Frazier speaking this week on South African TV. And President Robert Mugabe says in response that there will be war if anyone tries to make him step down. Let's look at news headlines for this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. To remind you that over the weekend, one of the great characters in the history of baseball died. Outspoken former pitcher Doc Ellis was a pitcher for the Pittsburgh Pirates from 1968 through 1979. He died of a liver ailment over the weekend, and we wanted to spend at least a few minutes remembering one of the great characters, whether you're talking about his style of play or his advocacy of race relations in Major League Sports. Joining us now is Al Oliver, who's a former Pittsburgh Pirate, and will be eulogizing Doc Ellis at a ceremony this coming weekend. Al, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Give me a sense of what kind of a character Doc was, just above and beyond his play on the field.
Well, first of all, definitely Doc was a character with character. And that in itself is something that is unique. Because normally characters, you know, you have a tendency to lean toward the negative. But in Doc's situation, being a character, he leaned toward the positive.
Ego was not a big word in Doc Ellis's life, right?
Oh, no. Now, that's one thing. Doc was not. He was a very caring person, down to earth, dealt with all types of people from the president on down to the lowest salaried human being on this earth. ego was not Doc's problem.
Now, Doc said that it would never happen that two soul brothers would pitch against each other, referring to the possibility of pitching against Vida Blue. Describe that story and where that came from in Doc's personality.
Well, Doc knew that, of course, you know, he made All-Star team that year. You know,
what year was that? What year was that?
1971.
71, right.
And, of course, you know, we went on to win the World Championship that year. And, of course, you know, on the American League side, Vida Blue from Oakland had made the All-Star team. So at the time, you know, they hadn't announced who would be the starting pitchers. So Doc began campaigning that he and Vida Blue start the All-Star game. Because, you know, in doing that, that would mean that two African-American pitchers would start in an All-Star game.
It's a huge deal in 71.
Exactly.
Right.
And so, as it turned out, it worked out that way. They did start.
And you can kind of see the wink in his eye. He was sort of taunting them to do something that he believed maybe wouldn't happen, but you knew all along that probably it would. We can't go without telling the story about the no-hitter against the Padres, right?
No.
Tell me that one quickly. Tell me that one real quick.
Very quickly, in San Diego, you know, when Doc pitched his no-hitter, you know, I was playing first base that night.
Right.
And, of course, I had no idea that, you know, as far as LSD was concerned.
he took LSD.
I had no idea that that was in the picture.
He took LSD for the game, and he pitched a no-hitter, and he said that it made him pitch better. Listen.
It was easier to pitch with the LSD because I was so used to medicating myself. That's the way I was dealing with the fear of failure. The fear of losing, the fear of winning. It's just that it was part of the game, you know. You get to the major leagues and you say, I got to stay here. What do I need?
A sense of candor there, Al, and a sense of self-reflection, I think, that you don't find in a lot of major league athletes. Just a couple of seconds. A final word, Al?
The final word is that he left here caring and doing something for people. He was dealing with people who had drug problems out in California.
And a hero to be remembered for all time in baseball. Former Pittsburgh Pirate Al Oliver remembering Doc Ellis. Thanks, Al.
My pleasure.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 22nd. Femi Okeh is here with the morning's headlines.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour. President-elect Barack Obama's review of his staff contacts with Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich is expected to be released tomorrow. That's according to Associated Press. Blagojevich is accused of trying to sell Obama's Senate seat. The Palestinian group Hamas is declaring a 24-hour ceasefire of rocket fire against Israel. It came into effect last night. They say the truce comes at the request of Egyptian mediators. Rocket attacks by militants spiked in recent days. And analysts think that an Israeli military operation could be in the works. I'm doing this story just so I can say Muntada Al-Zaidi. He's the gentleman who's accused of aggression against the foreign head of state. You may know him better as the journalist who threw shoes at President Bush. Now, he could face trial next week. He will face trial next week and possibly some jail time as well. And his brother claims that Al-Zaidi was abused in jail.
So there's so much chaos in Iraq, but they managed to come up with an insulting a world leader law.
Insulting a head of state.
And holding will, they managed to come up with
will
that?
Will yeah. be the charges.
Well, good for them. They got their priorities straight.
We will be following that trial for you. Okay, so finally, here's the voice of the nation's newest talk show host.
We do so while taking a different view of our country than that of the other party. Listening to them, you'd think that we were in the middle of a Great Depression, that we're down, disrespected, incapable of prevailing against challenges that face us.
Now, that's Fred Thompson, so the former senator, former actor and former presidential candidate and soon-to-be talk show host. He's going to take over Bill O'Reilly's old radio slot, and he will have a two-hour daily talk show, and that starts in March of next year.
So he was suggesting that things are good in the U.S.?
This was him talking at the Republican National Conference earlier this year, just a few months ago.
We call it a convention here in America.
Yeah, convention. Yeah. Yes, the convention. How could I forget that?
So memorable. Fred Thompson gets his own show.
It's called The Fred Thompson Show.
The Fred Thompson Show, yeah. I thought you were going to say Elvis Costello. You know, he has a talk show now, too. Why didn't he call it just Law & Order with Fred Thompson?
That would be good. People would watch it.
Yeah, of course.
Have you ever heard of, I got two words for you, copyright infringement.
Oh, that's right.
Bah humbug.
Dick Wolf,
yeah, he owns that one.
Mother Mary and Joseph, we got to get on with this show. What is it they say, Mother Mary and Joseph? The holidays can be tremendously arduous, but not more arduous for anyone other than Alim Maqbul, okay?
Right.
He's actually, let me tell you what he's doing.
Okay.
He's retracing the steps of the real Mother Mary and Joseph in the Holy Land between Nazareth and Bethlehem.
I love that story.
Yes, well, of course,
I love it.
He's been doing it for the BBC all week, and he joined us earlier from north of Ramallah, and I asked him, that's right north of Jerusalem, and I asked him first if he was actually talking to us from the donkey itself.
I'm not on the donkey. I'm looking at a very attractive backside of the donkey, which is facing me. It's just tied up not far away from me. It is actually donkey number 4, but I'm sure we'll get through all of that. But we are just north of Ramallah, as you say. I'm actually looking at some ruins right in front of me, and this is supposed to have been an ancient caravan stop where people traveling from the north, from places like Nazareth, heading to Jerusalem and further south to Bethlehem, would have stopped. So Mary and Joseph may well have stopped here on their journey, and it's believed that one of the stories in the Bible, in Luke's Gospel, actually happened here about 12 years later, you might remember it, where Mary and Joseph were traveling back from Jerusalem to Nazareth. They reached this stop one day's walk away from Jerusalem, and they realized that Jesus was missing, so they went back to Jerusalem and found him in a temple.
No, that's a great story, and it's not much told. The parenting of Mary and Joseph is sort of lost to the historical record, but for this story of them losing Jesus on the way back to Nazareth. Now, we can, sort of look at this as a kind of a travel journalistic stunt on some level, but really you have serious reasons for retracing these steps. There are all kinds of political contrasts, and I'm wondering what your motivation was to do this trip in the first place.
Well, I mean, I've been based in this region for about a year and a half, and on the spiritual side of covering the journey, on the Christmas story itself, we're surrounded by extraordinary, the names of fairy tales almost, the ones that we've grown up with around here, Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Nazareth, Jericho. But if you walk around areas like this, it's sometimes the landscapes, the hills and the valleys and the olive groves, where you sometimes feel, I'm really connected to history here, whether you believe the journey of Joseph and Mary happened or not. So much history happened around here, and you're connected to it. But of course, the journalistic side was to walk through, to stop places, and I've just come out of a little cafe here in Albira, and chat to people and hear their stories to try to learn just a little bit more of what is a very complex land, of course.
Well, we're going to play a little bit from your video diary, which shows, I guess it's safe to say, this is some of the maybe non-spiritual sort of events that occurred during this trip. But let me play this, and then you can explain what actually happened here. This apparently is some difficulty you had actually moving the donkey from north to south here. Here we go.
The Israeli authorities have told us that while I should be allowed through, the paperwork is not in order for the donkey. And so the donkey will have to be left here. So we've got to call the owner to get them to take her back.
Now, Maqbul, Joseph probably had the right papers. You really blew it here, it sounds like.
Yeah, actually, this was quite early on in the trek, because now Nazareth is in what is now Israel, and much of the rest of the trail is in the West Bank. So we had to cross our first Israeli military checkpoint, and we had spoken to the Israeli army a week or so beforehand to let them know what we were doing. But yes, apparently the paperwork was not in order. But actually, between you and me, I was quite pleased, because donkey number 2, who I was with at the time, wasn't brilliant. She didn't fancy walking very fast.
So it all worked out.
She didn't really like carrying things. She didn't really like carrying things. She just wanted to eat all day. We were building something of a relationship, but, you know, it would have slowed me down a lot.
And, of course, it's lost to the fog of history how many donkeys Joseph needed to get down to Bethlehem from Nazareth, too. So it's interesting that you had to use more than one, because Joseph undoubtedly had to use more than one.
Possibly. I mean, yeah. They might have taken a little longer than I did. And actually, donkey number three, incidentally, I would have loved to have kept on, but I thought she might have been... I got very attached to her, actually. She was just magic. We went through much of the hills of the northern West Bank together, and these really were the off-road treks, the ones that I was talking about in terms of reminding us what this place might have looked like at the time of whichever prophets went through here. But they were quite difficult climbs, and I thought, well, I've got a choice to do this. My donkey hasn't, so maybe she is a little bit tired. So after 3 days of that, we gave her a break. And I've got donkey number four, who's tied up now, who's very, very slow.
So what's the distance, Aleem? What's the distance on this trip, and what have you been struck by that you are surprised about?
It's about 150 kilometers. And I tell you what, the last day was interesting for me. I mean, there have been lots of interesting episodes along the way, but it's just we walked through a valley through what is now the center of the West Bank, a road called the Patriarch's Road, where it's believed Abraham, Mary and Joseph may have come down as well. And it's changed a lot even in the last 30 years. On the hilltops are Jewish settlements, and a lot of the world considers that those, in fact everyone except for Israel itself, believes that those Jewish settlements are illegal. They're built on occupied Palestinian land. And at the base of the hills are Palestinian villages, old Palestinian villages. And while I was walking through, I realized there is absolutely no connection. Speaking to people, they are from completely different worlds. There is no interaction between the different communities in the settlements and in the villages. And speaking to people, you just realize how entrenched people's views are and how difficult it will be to resolve this conflict.
Well, a very contemporary landscape with an echo of times of the Romans when Mary and Joseph actually had their own difficulties getting from north to south. BBC correspondent Aleem Maqbool joined us earlier. He's 2 or 3 days away from Bethlehem, retracing the steps of Mary and Joseph in the Holy Land from Nazareth to Bethlehem.
And we're doing some talking about current economic times here in the United States, and specifically about Columbia, South Carolina, a place, a city in some ways that really is a window into what's happening in the rest of the country. And we want to hear from you. What are you seeing in your town or your block that shows how the economy is doing?
Hi, this is Barbara Ann from Jersey City Heights, New Jersey. The economy has definitely affected our community. Many houses are boarded up. They're foreclosed. People have been evicted, even the tenants. If you go down Central Avenue or Commercial Street, a lot of empty stores. Businesses have gone out of business. We don't know what's going to happen after January 1st when the little bit of businesses that are there will close down because no one will be buying.
Tough times in
Jersey
City.
Tough times. We want to hear what's happening in your community. Be a reporter for us and tell us what you're seeing there at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And here's your takeaway.
Recession was manufactured on Wall Street, if it was manufactured anyplace in the United States.
That's Peter Morici, a professor at the University of Maryland School of Business and former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission, and our pal here at The Takeaway. And if you missed anything on the show, you can always take our podcast to go and subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.